Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has stressed new quality productive forces in deliberations or discussions with China's national lawmakers and political advisors. China's consumer price index, the main gauge of inflation, rose by 0.7% in February. U.S. has lifted its non-essential embassy personnel from Haiti as violence continues in the country. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese President Xi Jinping joined a deliberation with fellow deputies of the National People's Congress from the eastern province of Jiangsu. As the region has enjoyed strong economic growth, he stressed developing new quality productive forces based on local conditions. The president also called on the province to seek new opportunities for scientific and industrial revolution. Xi Jinping also visited national political advisors, attending a joint group meeting in Beijing last week. He listened to comments and suggestions from the advisors attending the annual session of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. The annual sessions of the NPC, China's top legislature, and the CPPCC, China's top advisory body, have concluded. For more, I earlier spoke with Dr. Zhang Gong, professor with University of International Business and Economics. The concept of new quality productive forces is a central proposition in the government work report this year. Xi Jinping said at a previous study session of China's top leadership that with innovation playing the leading role, new quality productive forces mean advanced productivity that is freed from traditional economic growth mode and productivity development paths, features high tech, high efficiency, and high quality, and comes in line with the new development philosophy. Professor, how do you understand new quality productive forces?
First of all, it's a very popular concept these days, ever since it's first mentioned by President Xi. I think what it refers to is really about, you know, the new technologies, the sunrise technologies, the cutting edge technologies that, you know, are causing a structural change in the leading economy, certainly including China's economy. So I'm thinking about, you know, when President Xi's talking about the new development model, I'm thinking about, you know, the Chinese economy transitioning away from the old growth model that is based on, say, you know, building infrastructures, real estate property markets, that kind of things. It's really towards sort of cutting edge technologies related to, for example, in artificial intelligence, robotics, quantum technologies, new biotech technologies. I mean, these are cutting edge stuff rising on the horizon. So I think what President Xi is really talking about are technologies related to these things. And not only these are things are sunrise technologies, the new things, but they are causing a fundamental transformation of China's economy towards a more quality growth model. I think that's the essence of this new concept that it's all about.
Now, Professor, specifically, how important is new quality productive forces to Jiangsu province? And in what industries can the province utilize these kind of forces?
Well, Jiangsu is a province itself. It's a very large economy. It's the largest or the second largest economy in terms of GDP among all the provinces in China. And this province is also famous for its manufacturing, especially between Shanghai and Nanjing in that corridor. It has a concentration of many more companies, high-tech companies, and also high-end manufacturing. So I think for the province to emphasize the importance of the new quality productive forces, you know, it calls for a transformation of the total economy, the manufacturing based economy. I mean, these manufacturing stuffs have to be transitioning towards a new level that is catering towards these new technologies that we've just been talking about.
Mm. On various occasions, Xi Jinping has stressed developing new quality productive forces should be based on local conditions. Why is that important?
Well, I think in China, you know, we have a history of whenever something new is coming, you know, everybody, mm-hmm. or every company or every province or local government will rush to that. And I think President Xi is, you know, making a precautionary statement that we should avoid that scenario. You know, this stuff is all based on innovation, that's for sure. But innovation, leveraging of local strength, local conditions, you know, that's what he's talking about. As opposed to having a sort of a wholesale rush towards these things, and investing in these things. And I think if that's the case, that would be just money wasted. So I think, you know, President Xi is making a cautionary note that, you know, local conditions, local characteristics are important for these very important investment decisions.
Well, at the deliberation of NPC deputies from Jiangsu, Xi Jinping said developing new quality productive forces is not neglecting or forsaking traditional industries. He said new technologies should be applied to improve traditional industries. So, Professor, how should we treat or deal with the relations of traditional industries and new or emerging industries in the process?
I would hypothesize that any new technology, any revolutionary technology coming on the horizon is usually, in history at least, I think, is usually done still in a very much evolutionary manner. I mean, the transition is not going to be wholesale overnight. It's going to be gradual. It's going to be evolutionary. And it's also going to take into consideration, you know, the investment, the install base of capabilities and facilities and technologies. As I said, you know, Jiangsu province is a manufacturing intensive province. I think what President Xi is talking about is that, you know, soaring to these new quality productive forces has to be, you know, based on trying to at least renovate or upgrading the existing capabilities and existing manufacturing facilities. We shouldn't just throw everything out of the door and invest in something new. Again, I think the important thing is to take an evolutionary approach make full use of the investments we have already made and leverage off that capabilities and then to invest into new areas.
Mm. Well, when meeting with advisors of the CPPCC in the field of science and technology, Xi Jinping elaborated on environmental protection. So, Professor, China is now transitioning to high-quality development. In that process, how should China deal with its agenda of carbon peak and carbon neutrality and economy?
Yeah, I think the goal of carbon peak and carbon neutrality, it's not only a national strategy, but I think also President Xi holds it very much to his heart personally. He has been emphasizing this, and I think this is the direction that the country is moving towards. I want to emphasize that investment in environmental protection not only is just for the environmental protection's sake, it's also actually it's a growth strategy. It creates opportunities. It creates investments because, after all, there will be technologies being developed to address these issues. And the development of these technologies means investment, means GDP growth, means jobs, means development in the local communities. So I think it's a very important thing that China is doing.
Mm. Well, Professor, the rhetoric of peak China has been spreading in some Western press over the past few months. These reports often cite factors such as population, real estate industry, etc., as evidences of China's inevitable economic slowdown. How would you comment on this theory of peak China?
Well, I totally reject it. I think the next China is still going to be China. This country still remains to be a very viable, very attractive place for investment. And I think the companies who stick to the Chinese market will stand to benefit eventually in the future. I think you know, if you look at the opportunities around, I mean, you know, we went rapidly transitioning towards a environmentally friendly economy, transition towards a you know, a technology intensive industries. China still is the world's largest exporter. You know, our exports actually growing amidst the headwinds last year, even though the global trade is decreasing. So I think, you know, after all, this is a still rapidly evolving and developing country. China is still a little bit far away from being full development status. Being a developed country, China's urbanization rate is still a bit far from being fully done. You know, we're still less than 70%. So all of these opportunities means that the peak China theory is going to be bankrupt in the future. There's too many opportunities in this market right now.
One more question, Professor. What are some of the external challenges for China's economic development moving forward in 2024?
You know, a couple of things. One is, of course, the international environment. You know, we are facing geopolitical challenges. You know, the United States is having a fierce grand competition against us. They're adopting measures and policies essentially to boycott Chinese companies. That's a big challenge. And the world economy, to be frank, is also another challenge in my view in this year. Because we're going to still see quite anemic growth in many parts of the world. China being a exports heavily dependent country is going to be affected by that. Other than that, I think you know, maybe restoring domestic investment confidence among the private sector remains to be a challenge. I think this is still a hangover issue over the last 3 years. The investment, the market sentiment hasn't fully recovered yet. It's still going to take some time to recover. So I think these are, you know, very short list of the challenges we're facing. But, you know, I think after all, 5% economic growth rate target, is that much compared to last year, right? I mean, 2022, we still have 5% as a goal. And eventually we achieve something a little bit more than that. So I think probably the same thing is going to happen this year. I think the 5% growth rate target is very much reachable.
That was Dr. Zhang Gong, professor with University of International Business and Economics. Coming up, our interview with Ali Abbas Ramey from 24 News HD in Pakistan on his observation on China's two sessions. You're listening to World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. China's two sessions have captured the attention of journalists worldwide, and among them is Ali Abbas Ramey from 24 News HD in Pakistan. In an interview with my colleague Gao Yingshi, Ali shares his observations of the two sessions and reflects on his experiences in China. He also discusses the global implications of the Belt and Road Initiative, emphasizing its role in enhancing connectivity and strengthening economic ties between China and other countries. Let's take a listen.
Ali, thank you for joining us. I know it's your first time covering the China's two sessions. So what's your first impression about these two sessions?
Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. Before that, I was really don't know what is two sessions. It's really by God. But now, after that, I can say through my observation that this is really an amazing experience I had in my life to see how two session works here in China. And, you know, In international perspective, two-session demonstrates China's openness and transparency in governance. They allow foreign observers, journalists, and diplomats to gain the insights about the two-session, that how two-sessions work. And I learned this thing first time that two-session is not only belongs to the one party. Everybody can participate in this session and they can voice their policies in this matter, like when they are doing to legislate some good things about the betterment of the China, for the betterment of the people, for the well-being of the people of China. So I can say through my observation that that's really a good platform. And we will only know about that only one party is doing everything is there in China. No. Through the President Xi's vision, invite everybody, lest they have a platform here. They can participate, they can put their observation, they can put their decision, they can put their opinion in two session, and then they will make a policy. So it's a really interesting thing that I learned in China about the two session.
Among all the proposals in this year's two sessions, which area grabbed your attention the most and why?
When the Prime Minister of China, when he mentioned about the BRI, that they already have a BRI forum and they put some agenda like with the 8 points, and he says that with the BRI forum, with the BRI initiative, they will move forward, they will keep moving towards the globalize. You know, only two session belongs to the China. But when he mentioned the BRI, then we understand that the two session is not only belong to China. Two session is also belong to the world, to the global, that everybody, they were looking to the two session, what they're going to make a policy about the globalize. And obviously, you know that the BRI is very important for the underdeveloped countries, like in Pakistan. It's a very important initiative that the President Xi Jinping used this kind of stuff for the betterment of the people, not only for the road and construction. And I already said that the BRI is not about the construction of road and bridges. It's also about connecting people and their culture. So after BRI, the well-being of people. This is the most interesting thing that from the two session I've learned, that two session is concerned about the betterment of the people of China. And they're spending a lot of money and they have a lot of policies to do some more better things for the Chinese people. They mentioned that they're going to cut their extra expenditure of the central government. That was really important for me, being a journalist from the Pakistan, because we are spending a lot of money and on the service delivery. But that was the extra expenditure we are doing. And that's why, let me add this thing that IMF, they're asking us, you need to cut down your extra expenditure from your own budget. But now China, they are cutting down their own extra expenditure from the central government, but they are spending, they are allocating a lot of budget for the local government. So that was very important because they were literally using their money for the municipal government, for the education, for the health sector. As we know that they raised some pension funds, some medical insurance, and they're also creating 12 million jobs in this year. They did a promise to the youth of China. They will give them 12 million jobs. So that's really interesting for me.
Reflecting on your visits to cities like Beijing, Chengdu, and regions like Xizang and Yunnan, how do you see the diversity of economic development across China? And have you noticed any unique economic strengths specific to these areas?
Across China, there's a remarkable diversity in economic development in each region, showcasing their economic development. Like if we talk about Beijing, a hub of tech, and fostering industries like a technology. And if we talk about the Chengdu and Hangzhou, Chengdu is, they can boost the economy with the manufacturing and other stuff. And if we talk about the Yunnan, capitalized with the natural resources, they can boost the economy with the tourism in this region.
How do you see the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, also known as CPEC, evolving in the current economic climate? And How has this project impacted your daily life or daily lives for people you have observed?
That's a really interesting question. And you know that under the BRI, China investing a lot of money on our China-Pakistan Economic Corridor project. And China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, just not about the one road. Let me give you one example that if the citizen of Beijing, they are traveling in a modern train, in a subway, a citizen of my city in Pakistan, in Lahore, they're also traveling in a modern train like the citizen of Beijing, they are traveling in a subway. And with the help of joint venture of China, Norinkan Company, they construct the Orange Train project in Lahore. And other people, say citizen of my city, they are traveling on this modern train. And before that, we were traveling on some auto rickshaws in the summer, and that was very difficult. But now, we're traveling in a modern train. Another, like a Gwadar port is very important for us. And they are construction airport in Gwadar. They're constructing a hospital, and they also install a filtration plants for the betterment of water.
It's your second time traveling to China. Which parts of China impress you the most?
I've experienced to visit USA and UK. I've been there in USA twice and spent 2 years in UK. But the most interesting thing that touched me, that was the infrastructure of China. First, Hangzhou City. That's a really amazing city. And I heard before that the Chinese people call this a paradise of China. That's really true. Very beautiful infrastructure I've seen first time in my life. And if we talk about the Chengdu, it's a happier city. The infrastructure of Chengdu city, this was really amazing. You know, China's investment for the betterment of the infrastructure, that's really impressed us. That's really impressed me. And if we talk about the people of China, oh my God. Let me tell you an interesting story. When I was here first time in China, the first week the tear was in my eyes. Why am I visiting China? That nobody was here to talk with me. On that moment, I was really feeling a homesickness. But after immersion of my 4 months here in China, when I was going back to my home, I was going back with the same teary eyes. I am going back to my home. That's the true love I got from the Chinese people. Infrastructure is another thing. But the most interesting thing that is that beautiful places doesn't make beautiful people, but beautiful people makes beautiful building, beautiful infrastructure. That's my understanding. So that's why Chinese people, they are very warm welcome, not only for the Pakistan, for globalize. And I've seen a lot of time because I was here with my other journalists from around the world. They were very warm. Warm welcome. They are very warm welcome for the everybody, for the foreigners. And through this interview, I would say to the foreigner people, if you want to see the real love, if you want to see the real warm welcome, you need to come here in China. You need to see by their own eyes, not by the eyes with the Western media, while they are doing propaganda against China. No, no, no. There's no language barrier here in China. You can speak English. Chinese people can speak English. And that was my experience. And now that, and I mentioned this in my speech that China and Pakistan shared a friendship anthem, and it's called You Have Stolen My Heart. And after my stay in China, I must say that rings true. In China, you have captivated my heart.
That was Ali Abbas Ramey from 24 News HD in Pakistan talking to my colleague Gao Yingshi about his observations of the two sessions and his thoughts on the Belt and Road Initiative. Coming up, the latest figures on China's Consumer Price Index, the main gauge of inflation. Also, U.S. airlifts its non-essential embassy personnel in Haiti as violence continues in the country. You're listening to World Today. For more discussions, you can follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. We'll be right back after a short break.
I am Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank, China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Official data show that China's consumer price index, the main gauge of inflation, rose by 0.7% in February year on year. This is a clear signal of the warming of domestic demand. In the same month, the producer price index, or PPI, fell by 2.7% year on year. Meanwhile, China's total imports and exports of goods surged to a record high in the first 2 months of the year, registering an 8.7% year on year growth in yuan terms. Exports have seen robust growth, expanding by over 10%, with shipments of mechanical products, including integrated circuits and automobiles, accounting for close to 60% of the exports. Private enterprises continue to be the backbone of China's foreign trade, contributing to more than half of the country's total. For more on this and China's economy, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Yao Shujie, Chang Kong Professor of Economics with Chongqing University.
So, Professor Yao, we are seeing China's CPI rose by 0.7% in February year on year, and this is also up 1% compared with the previous months. So how do you explain it, and what kind of momentum does it reflect for the economy?
Yeah, I think it's quite encouraging to see the CPI recover to the positive territory. 0.7% is still relatively low, but compared with the previous months, it increased by 1%, which is really encouraging. It implies that the consumer's market is now becoming very positive. And you can see a lot of prices are going up rather than going down, as we see in the previous months. A little bit cautious is about the factory gate price, the PPI, which still dropped by 2.7%. But it is a reasonable outcome because of the production system usually take more time to recover than the consumption market. But we also see some encouraging news, like the export increased by two digits, over 10%, and import-export amount increased by 8.7%, measured in RMB terms. So overall, you see this kind of figure in the first 2 months, particularly last month. I think the Chinese economy is recovering very well. And why the recovery takes so much time? And it is slowly recovering is because of the external environment, the COVID-19 pandemic, and also the slowdown of economic growth in Europe and in the rest of the world. So China, as the second largest economy, to have this kind of performance to stimulate the domestic market is still a fairly admirable outcome. So I hope the rest of the year would do much better.
So, Professor, you mentioned that for the first 2 months of this year, the foreign trade is up 8.7% in yuan's terms, and exports in this period of time rose over 10%, and imports were up 6.7%. And this is better than expected. So why is it such a robust momentum?
Yeah, the low mountain is due to two factors. I think the first factor is that in the previous year, we see a slowdown of China's export. But this year, the exporting enterprises, they have been trying very hard to increase their international competitiveness. The second reason is China is actually transforming from a low technological product to a medium and high-level technological product, especially the new, the so-called new, product like energy vehicles, electricity vehicles, and also solar power panels, and the new energy batteries. Those are emerging to become China's major export. So, and this is the area that China is now enjoying a very strong advantage compared to the international competitors, such as the Western advanced economies.
Mm. And you talk about the foreign trade, you know, in the EVs, in lithium batteries and the solar panels. So tell us more about EVs, for example. How is it, you know, become so competitive on the global market?
The EV is one of the Chinese economy miracle, I would say. China have been relying on foreign brand names such as VW, Toyota, more recently, BMW and Mercedes, two have joint ventures. But in the traditional vehicle sector, China take many years to advance the technology, but it never catch up or surpass with the most advanced manufacturer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the private sector in particular, emerged to be a fairly strong front runners in the energy, in the new vehicle energy sector. China is emerged not only in the new battery, but also the vehicle, the whole production system, the technological system. China have the most innovative outcome. And this is why the new energy vehicle is emerging to become fairly strong.
Mm.
China is able to produce the same kinds of product or even better, selling at probably the half price of the other brand name.
Mm. And you mentioned the private sector. Actually, private enterprises continue to be the backbones of China's foreign trade, contributing more than half of the country's total. So what are the main factors driving that?
Well, this is due to Chinese success of encouraging the free market economy. Lots of rumors and accusations that China is encouraging the state-owned sector at the expenses of the private sector. In reality, is untrue. You can see that the private sector has become more and more important in the Chinese economy, including export. You can see the percentage of export accounted by the private sector have been increasing over the time. And this year in particular, the export of the whole country is 10%, but the private sector is 16%. So you can see the private sector in the Chinese market, as long as there's opportunity, they will grab it and they will expand it.
Mm. And how do you expect for China's fiscal and monetary policy this year to support the economic recovery and growth? Actually, China plans to issue the special government bonds, the ultra-long government bonds, starting from this year and over the coming years. So how will this help shore up the investment and consumption?
You know, as you just mentioned, in the government report to the People's Congress conference this year, the Premier Li Qiang, he said the government would allow the budget deficit to be as high as 3%. But in the meantime, he also announced a 1 trillion ultra long term, state bond. Why we need this kind of financial stimulus, particularly at this moment? Because China's economy is entering a period of significant transformation, as I mentioned, from a low and medium level technological economy to a medium and high level technological economy. That means that the country need to invest heavily in research and innovation, in major national projects and infrastructure, and also the new emerging system, such as the AI, new energy, and so on and so forth. So it requires a lot of investment to create this kind of platform and system. So this is why China need a budget deficit in the ultra long-term bond. Mm-hmm. And this is the necessary conditions, the necessary strategies to make sure the growth target of 5% is achieved.
That was Yao Shujie, Changkang Professor of Economics with Chongqing University. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Einar Tangen, a political and economic analyst and senior fellow at the independent Taihe Institute. World Today is news without the hype and business commentary that is informed and up to date, presenting the facts and asking incisive questions. So, join us if you are someone who needs to know what is happening in China as it is happening.
Welcome back. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The U.S. military has airlifted its non-essential embassy personnel from Haiti and bolstered embassy security. The Caribbean nation has been under a state of emergency after criminal groups unleashed havoc in recent days. The criminals control much of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and roads leading to the rest of the country. Their goal is to oust the prime minister. The unrest has seen over 360,000 Haitian people internally displaced, with over half of them children. Poppy Futhing has more.
Violence in Haiti has escalated, prompting an evacuation of the U.S. embassy. Non-essential staff have been airlifted to safety. Turmoil has been ongoing in recent days and weeks as gangs have overrun the capital, Port-au-Prince. Led by leader Jimmy Chersier, known as Barbecue, who is demanding Prime Minister Ariel Henry step down. Violence has been escalating since two prison breaks and the escape of 3,800 prisoners, and local gangs joining forces to overthrow the government. Barbecue said if there isn't a handover of power, there will be a civil war that will lead to genocide. Henri came to power with U.S. support after the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moise. No elections were ever held. The prime minister is currently in Puerto Rico, where he's been since last month. Haiti is facing a humanitarian crisis, with schools and hospitals closed. 15,000 people have been displaced. Ports and the airport are on lockdown.
The U.S. has not offered military support, providing only medical and communications resources.
That was Poppy Futhing on the situation in Haiti. For more, we're joined by Jiang Shixue. He's distinguished professor at College of International Relations. Thank you, Professor Jiang, for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
Now, Professor, how do you comment on this current situation in Haiti? I mean, how did it end up where it is right now?
Well, I would say the current situation in Haiti is terrible. It's somewhat uncontrolled. So really, we do not have the capacity to say what will happen. Well, when we say what is the so-called root cause of the crisis now, I think it has something to do with the direct incident. Two of the biggest prisons in Haiti fell down. So about 4,000 prisoners went out of the cells. So these people just do not follow the rules and the laws. So that means the gang crimes have become more and more serious. And at the same time, the government just cannot control the whole situation. You know, in a word, we can say Haiti is really a failed state. So really, no one knows what will happen.
Professor, the country's prime minister, Ariel Henry, is in Puerto Rico right now and appearing to be refusing the idea of stepping down. How do you see his considerations right now, Professor?
Well, the crisis, I think, has something to do with the political struggle inside the Caribbean country. Different factions competing for power. So I really don't know when the prime minister will end its asylum. I believe for the time being, we cannot say that he will return. And for the time being, it is believed that there will be a kind of interim government, but who knows? This temporary government can really control the situation. So before it gets better, it will become worse and worse.
Professor, you earlier touched upon the escape of prisoners in the country, talking about the general picture, especially in terms of the economy and the society, how do you see the background of the rising gang violence in the country?
Well, as I said just now, Haiti is a failed state. So by saying failed state, it means the economy is in a terrible shape. Social stability is in chaos. And the political struggle is very fierce. So everything is terrible in Haiti. Gang crimes have been a big problem for so many years. Well, it depends on whether the government can really manage this kind of situation. But as we said just now, the government cannot do anything at all. And the president of the country was assassinated almost 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knows who killed the president. So you can imagine the gangs will continue to rule Haiti for the foreseeable future.
Mm.
I believe that some external help might ease this kind of situation. The UN should send more peacekeeping forces to Haiti, and the Caribbean countries should offer certain kinds of help, particularly for economic help and some other external assistance should come. Otherwise, really, this country will become really terrible.
The country is indeed in a dire humanitarian situation at the moment. But thank you. That was Professor Jiang Shixue, Distinguished Professor at College of International Relations. You're listening to World Today. We'll be right back after a short break.
Welcome. I'm Elaf Ellard, Economics Professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Neuralink founder Elon Musk said his neurotech startup has implanted its device in a human for the first time. Musk earlier said the patient was recovering well. The company is developing a brain implant aimed at helping patients with severe paralysis control external technologies using only neural signals. It began recruiting patients for its first in-human clinical trial last autumn, after U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the study in May. For more, I earlier spoke with Andy Mok, tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization.
First up, help us understand the basic science of this. What kind of implant is this and why is it able to move a person's body?
Sure. Well, there's two, I think, main components of this. One, this is a physical device that I think is about the size of a U.S. quarter, so a 25-cent piece, that is physically implanted over a part of a person's brain. And then this device is used to pick up signals from the brain. So when the neurons, the cells of the brain, fire or emit an electrical impulse, this device picks it up, transmits it to an outside device that can be used to control a cursor on a computer or perhaps a prosthetic limb. So the two parts here are important to point out. First, actually implanting a device into people's brains is not that difficult. That's mm-hmm. something that's been done for some treatments. It's considered a fairly conventional therapy. The big question is, can this device, after it's implanted, really do what Neuralink and other people hope it will do, meaning that can it capture the right signals? Can these signals be transmitted and converted into controlled movements. So I think it's the second part that's in question.
Andy, Elon Musk said, quote-unquote, initial results show promising neuron spike detection. That refers to, you know, the cellular activity between our brains and our nerve systems. I'm sure you've been following this. So what strikes you most about, you know, the science parts, the papers, and the research results on this?
Some scientists say, and I'm not a scientist, is that we have to be careful what this actually means. And without seeing the data, it's hard to draw any absolute conclusions. But a hopeful interpretation of it means that the right signals are being picked up. So, yeah, that's a crucial first step. But then can that then be translated into some physical movement that is controlled by a person's brain? And I think that's the middle part. And my understanding is that it will take a little bit of time, at least, for these signals to be gathered and processed before we will know whether it actually can control movement in the way that is desired and intended.
Elon Musk said the initial users will be those who have lost the use of their limbs. And here's what he said, quote-unquote, imagine if a Stephen Hawking could communicate faster than a speed typist or auctioneer. That's the goal. I mean, how do you see the prospects of that?
Well, I think it certainly would solve a very important problem and a very severe problem. That being said, the number of people that are suffering from, I believe the term is quadriplegia, where they have lost the use of their four limbs due to some sort of nervous system trauma. So, yes, I mean, that could be life-changing for people. But I think that the broader use case is much more profound, and that once you can do that, you can restore movement somehow through an exoskeleton or whatever to someone that is suffering from quadriplegia. You could use it to control artificial devices in your brain. And then, you know, it becomes science fiction, right? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's the ultimate vision. Because, again, if you could solve the problem for someone that has lost the use of their own limbs, maybe it's not that far a jump then to control something that was not originally part of your body.
What other medical areas can this technology be applied into, in your observation?
Well, I think this really depends, right? Mm. So, of course, it can be used to help people regain movement they've lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one. Another could be augmentation. So this is not necessarily replacing function you already have, but giving you functions you never had.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be cognitively. Maybe you can be augmented through a computer. So your brain, you know, we see this in the movie The Matrix, right, where you download new information to your brain as Neo, the Keanu Reeves character, gets an upload of information and suddenly he knows Kung Fu, right? that's another. And, you know, we could either say that there are diseases of the brain where people's brains can't do certain things, and through this implant, this augmentation, they now can. But it can give ordinary people superhuman powers as well. Is another, we can think of it as a kind of a medical case, I suppose.
Right. Now, Andy, help us understand the global picture. I mean, how are other countries which are traditionally strong in medical technologies, you know, for example, Europe or Australia, I mean, how are they progressing in this area?
Well, I think if we want to think about this broadly as brain-computer interface, as an area, you know, I believe all major countries are looking at this. And again, are we at a kind of a ChatGPT moment, meaning that there's many entities, many countries working on this area, but someone, you know, kind of finds that unlocks the Rubik's Cube, right, where it captures the popular imagination and, you know, they've packaged it in a way that becomes much more accessible. Now, that being said, clearly this requires a surgical procedure. So It's not like overnight there'll be millions or tens of millions of people doing this, but conceptually, you know, that might be one way to understand what's going on.
So, Andy, there have been ethical concerns on this issue. I mean, what are some of the main concerns here, especially on whether and where, you know, humanity should draw the line in our integration with technology?
Sure. Well, you know, I think there's, I would say, micro-level ethical issues in that, you know, is it responsible to be doing this to humans without really knowing what's going to happen? And we could make an argument that if you're a consenting adult, you know, you can freely choose these risks. So if it goes horribly wrong, you know, you can't blame the company. But the broader ethical issues I think you touched on are, what does this do to equality? More profoundly, if we become cyborgs, part human, part machine, what does it then mean to be human? So this raises actually questions very similar to artificial intelligence, in that it may profoundly change the political foundation of what we base society on, and may even change what it means to be human.
Andy Mark, tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of the headlines. Chinese President Xi Jinping has stressed new quality productive forces in deliberations or discussions with China's national lawmakers and political advisors. China's consumer price index rose by 0.7% in February. U.S. has airlifted its non-essential embassy personnel from Haiti as violence continues in the country. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. For further discussions, follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.